Hey, hi, how are you? Welcome back.
Yeah, we're back.
To Conspiracies and Cryptids.
Yeah,
with Sammy and Tessa.
Yeah, we're getting close to St. Patrick's Day.
It is in 2 days.
2 days, that's exciting.
So, I don't know if you have plans for St. Patrick's Day.
I definitely don't, because I just had a birthday party and I have no plans.
Yeah, I don't plan that far enough ahead, so... I will be wearing green.
Yes.
Because my uniform is green.
Well, that's good. I'll be wearing a onesie because I have a clover onesie.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
And I will definitely be celebrating my very Irish heritage, my like 40 some odd percent Irish heritage.
Oh, do a little drinking.
I don't know about that.
Maybe a few potatoes.
Definitely some potatoes.
Yeah.
Definitely some potatoes, you know,
I'm a
because
fan of the potatoes.
I have to eat as many as I can to make up for the entire potato famine where nobody had potatoes.
You've got to make up for lost time.
I've got to do my part.
Get on it.
Got to do my part as an Irishman.
Get those spuds. Get my spuddy buddy.
I was wondering who was going to make a joke about a spud bud first, and you beat me to
I
it.
I did.
A spuddy buddy. Okay,
spuddy
I like
buddy.
That.
Oh, adorable.
Okay.
All right. So I think it's time to flip a coin,
it's
right?
It's time for the penny for our thoughts.
Okay.
So you flip it this time.
Okay, I flip it this time. And you pick.
And I pick. I'm going to pick heads.
Heads again. Guys.
This is 4 episodes in a row.
Five, maybe. 6.
I don't
Who's
even
counting?
Know. It's getting a little ridiculous.
Oh. But let's start with a cryptid again.
Let's start with a cryptid.
That's
again.
All right. We'll save the best for last.
Mm. Yes, yes, we will. Yes, we will. So, in honor of St. Patrick's Day, I decided to do an Irish cryptid.
I
no,
love
don't
it.
Get carried away. It's
oh,
not leprechauns.
Dang it. It's not my lucky
Though
day.
I did consider that. It's not your lucky day. Yes. Like I said, I did consider leprechauns, but I was like, no.
But it was your golden opportunity. I hear the sniff from behind the curtain.
But I felt like that was too obvious, way, way too obvious. So instead, I am talking about a different Irish cryptid.
Oh.
So let me give you my little introduction first, okay?
Move over, Clover.
Move over. Oh, my God. You are just full of it tonight.
It's very close to a very punny holiday.
You just got, you know, the luck of the Irish on your side. Okay, so growing up as an extremely sheltered child, it was quite common for things in media to scare me. However, since most of the media that I consumed as a sheltered child was Disney or Disney adjacent, I got scared by traditionally not so scary things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was absolutely petrified of the giant from Mickey and the Beanstalk.
Yeah, okay. Valid.
Or the creepy talking book from the Care Bears movie.
Okay. I actually don't remember that movie.
There was like a creepy, like spell book that had like this woman's face inside it, and it was an evil spell book, and she would possess the kids.
Weird.
Yeah, like my parents actually threw that movie away.
That's rightful to be.
So yes, I was terrified of that. However, one Disney villain that I had every right to be scared of sticks out in my mind, and no, I'm not talking about Chernabog, the terrifying devil from Fantasia. I'm talking about the banshee that made an appearance in Disney's Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Ooh. Ooh, cool.
So yes, we are talking about the Irish banshee.
The banshee.
Which is a very traditional Irish cryptid and mythological creature.
I didn't know it was Irish. I've heard of it, but I didn't know it was Irish. Interesting.
Yep. The word banshee comes from an old Irish word that translates to woman of the fairy mound or fairy woman. They're female spirits that are harbingers of death, usually for that of a family member, and they signal this by wailing, screaming, shrieking, or keening, which is a traditional part of mourning in Ireland and parts of Scotland. In fact, the term keening woman refers to a professional mourner who was hired to wail laments at the funeral services.
Wow. Whether you know the person or not, you just hired them to show up.
I mean,
just
it was a very
sad.
It was a very highly sought after profession.
Interesting.
Some of the best keeners in history, like they were super expensive to hire. you know, because they were literally professional mourners.
Wow.
You know, and they would, it wasn't like they were just there sobbing. They were wailing, like traditional Irish laments and, you know, like death poems, I guess. I don't know exactly, but it was, you know, like they were literally professional mourners who were there to like mourn and put on kind of a sort of production for the funeral service.
Wow.
Yeah. So pretty interesting. Hmm. Although the first written accounts of banshees can be traced back as far as 1380, the legend itself dates back to the 8th century, or the 700s for those of us who struggle with centuries. Me.
Always.
In the original tales, banshees only lamented the deaths of the five most prominent Gaelic families, the O'Gradys, the O'Neills, the O'Briens, the O'Connors, and the Kavanaughs.
All very Irish names.
Very
I see.
Irish names. Mm-hmm. Yes. Apparently, these families did not need to hire a mortal keening woman, as a fairy would take on the responsibility. They were that important in Ireland.
Wow.
So, yeah, they were the most important Gaelic families, so the fairy realm would give their own keening woman.
They hired the big guns, I see.
They didn't hire them.
They just showed up.
They would just show up.
Wow.
However, over the centuries, as families blended together and spread apart, every family soon acquired their own individual banshee.
Oh, they have personal banshees now. I see.
Yes. So, yeah, like I said, back when it started, apparently only the five families had a personal banshee.
Wow.
But yeah, as, you know, time goes on, families expand.
Banshees breed, you know.
Apparently, maybe not breed, but the fairy realm just gives each family that has, you know, their own banshee. So
interesting.
Yeah. So a description of the banshee is they have long, stringy hair, either red or gray, pale skin, either an old hag or a beautiful woman, no in between.
Oh.
Yeah.
So there's no average Annie's. No.
No. It's usually a very young, beautiful woman or a very terrifying old hag.
Oh.
So I guess it's up to your family's history, which you get blessed or cursed with, I guess.
Kind of a toss-up who you wake up with in the morning. I see.
Yeah. No, it's not always said that. Well, yeah, okay, never. It does say beautiful woman. I was going to say young woman, but no, it specifically says beautiful. Sometimes the banshee has rotten teeth. Mm. All of them have bloodshot eyes from all of the crying.
Oh.
Because, once again, professional mourners.
Good detail.
Sometimes they have a comb in their hair because they have long, stringy hair. They need that comb. They wear a gray cloak over a green dress. Sometimes they're described as extremely short in stature, between 1 or 4 feet tall. And sometimes they are unnaturally tall. So, once again, no in between. They're either really small fairy creatures.
Unnaturally short or
very unnaturally tall.
Interesting.
Now into sightings. There's really not a lot of them. So this is kind of going to be a short one for me tonight. The earliest sighting is from February 21st, 1737. King James I of Scotland was approached by an Irish seer, who was like a seer is like a psychic sort of thing, who predicted the monarch's assassination. Not long after this approach, the king found himself trapped inside a sewer tunnel where he was fatally injured. The seer was strongly rumored to have been a banshee.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh. So they have powers too. Or.
Well, they, you know, they're, like I said, they're a harbinger of death.
Yeah,
so,
that's
I mean,
true.
You know,
makes sense.
They always predict the death of a family member or yourself.
Got
you
it.
Know?
Got it. I see.
So, yeah.
See.
So they just, you know, this could have been a banshee, like, standing in as a seer, or like, you know, like hiding themselves as a seer.
Interesting.
Yeah. Ooh. And basically predicted his death. The next one comes from 1642. At midnight, Lady Fanshawe was woken suddenly by a ghastly supernatural scream. Leaping upright in bed, she was greeted by a young, handsome woman hovering outside the window in the moonlight. The woman was pale, with disheveled, loose red hair, and wearing a dress in the style of the ancient Irish. The apparition stayed for some time and then disappeared with two loud shrieks. When morning came, Lady Fanshawe, not without some trepidation, told her host what she had seen. Her friend looked at her gravely and explained that she had seen the family banshee, the ghost of a woman of inferior rank who married one of his ancestors. So this is basically saying that the banshees are no longer fairy folk or fae folk. They are dead relative, like dead ancestors. So let's see. The ghost of a woman of inferior rank who married one of his ancestors, but he drowned her in the moat to atone for the shame he had brought on his family. She had come that night, as she always did, to announce a death in the family. One of his relations passed away in her sleep.
Ooh. Ooh.
So, yeah, so she came and screamed and basically was predicting the death of a family member.
And in the morning, somebody was dead.
Yep.
Ooh.
Yep. Now we're going to get into more recent times, like the 20th and 21st century. These are the last two that I have. And oh my God, I'm really... Too short. I should have picked something.
It's all right.
Better.
No. It's really interesting, though.
I like it, but it's too short. 1948. A man saw an old lady standing outside his front door when he was coming home from a night out. When he tried to speak to her, she backed away, pointed at the door, and wailed. Upon entering his house, he found his mother standing inside. When he told her about the woman, she said she knew who it was and told him to go to bed. In the morning, his uncle was found dead in his bed.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, and the mom apparently knew what was going on. It was like, this is the family banshee.
Yep.
We can expect a death. Don't even worry about it because there's nothing we can do, just I guess.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
Swept under the rug.
Yep. And then the most recent one is from June of 2014. So only, you know, like just under 5 years ago.
Hmm.
This one is written in first person. So I couldn't find a lot of information on this one. Or maybe I'm writing this myself. Maybe I wrote this in first person. I think I did.
You should put your notes in italics.
couldn't find a lot of information on this one. But apparently late one night, a man catcalled a woman who turned out to be a banshee.
Ooh.
So this is kind of a
dangerous.
Guy, this is kind of a, you know, guy gets his comeuppance,
that's
I guess.
Some bad luck to me too, a banshee.
I mean, don't me too a banshee. So the sound of her wail metamorphosed into a shrill scream that seemed to be coming closer and closer. The witness involved investigated from within the relative safety of indoors and reported a woman standing out in the open, head back, screaming loudly enough to cause irritation to the ears of the witnesses. After several more minutes, a single police patrol car arrived on the scene, but whatever was seen outside had disappeared. The attending police officers actually suggested the possibility of a banshee sighting.
Whoa.
The police did.
Whoa.
Yes. On the same night, a death in the family of the sole witness was recorded.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Right?
Wow.
And yeah, the police
were like, this is probably what this is.
Oh, saints, parsar of us, this is a banshee. Oh, please don't stop listening to us, our Irish listeners.
No, that's,
I'm so sorry.
That's probably one of the best accents you've done.
Oh.
I'd say.
Oh, well.
That's pretty, that's, at least well, from my perspective, I mean. Oh, that was pretty good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh my God, thank you.
You're Irish. You can take it.
I guess.
Take it.
I still feel bad. Please don't stop listening to me. So explanation is as to, there's actually only one explanation as to what a banshee might be outside of the supernatural. And it's that it is a barn owl.
Oh.
Barn owls are actually very large owls.
Those things are freaky.
They are found on every continent except Antarctica.
Oh.
Which would explain why banshees, they started out in Ireland, but they, you know, the legend has actually expanded to pretty much anywhere, you know, almost every Irish family, despite whether they're living in Ireland or not, still claims to have a banshee.
Wow.
So, like I said, could be a barn owl. They live everywhere. They have a white underbelly. They move very gracefully to the extent where it looks like they're floating.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it kind of looks like a white floating specter, and they have a very shrill scream, you know, like they sound really, really terrifying. I wonder if I can find a barn owl.
When I was, when I was a teenager, we used to go hang out on this, you know, we were obviously trespassing in places we were not supposed to be. And, you know, super, super late at night. And there was one night we got chased out of a building by an owl. And those things are scary.
Oh,
I can
terrifying.
See how people can think that could be like an entity that's like coming for you, especially when they're screeching and they've got those huge wingspans. I mean,
like I said, they're really big.
I would believe that.
There's a YouTube video that's just called Barn Owl or Feather Banshee.
For so 10 hours?
No, 26 seconds.
Oh, damn.
Yeah?
Yeah?
I could mistake that for like a supernatural scream of...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'll post that somewhere.
Yeah, please do.
But yeah, so that is like a possible explanation for maybe where the legend got started, is that, you know, somebody just came across a creepy owl late at night. And ironically enough, owls are also considered a symbol of death.
Oh.
They are oftentimes, you know, in mythology and legend and lore, considered a harbinger of death. So it's kind of an ironic coincidence that it could also be what is behind the legend of the banshee.
Or owls just are banshees. That's entirely likely too.
Yep. Yeah. So, but yeah, so that's the banshee.
I like it.
Like I said, I wish I had more to talk about with it, but there's not a lot of like recorded or documented sightings. It's a lot of just legend and lore.
Yeah.
It's super interesting. Like I said, I remember it from a very young age.
I didn't know that was Irish. That's very interesting. Yeah.
And like I said, I don't know if you've ever seen Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
I haven't actually.
It was one of Disney's earlier forays into live action movies.
Oh.
It actually had Sean Connery in it.
Oh, wow.
In his younger days when he was a young, handsome young buck.
Oh, so in the like pre...
I think it was around the Bond
time. Around
the
Bond days, okay.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, very young, very handsome.
Good pull, Disney.
But it was a really interesting movie. It followed this man and his name was obviously Darby O'Gill, and his daughter. And yeah, he, you know, like got caught up with like a bunch of leprechauns, and a banshee was one of the primary villains in the movie. It came to try to like, you know, kill his daughter, and he basically like sacrificed himself, you know, and kind of like gave himself over to the banshee.
Wow.
And you know, the banshee was that old, it was done in that old kind of animation where they did like animation and then like put it over the top of live action, you know.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It was literally like hand painted animation.
Yeah, yeah.
That was like superimposed over the live action.
Wow.
And it was like made see through and stuff like that. And I mean, you know, it was absolutely terrifying, and the screams and wailing they put in with it. Yeah, I had nightmares as a child from that.
No kidding.
I'm pretty sure my brother did too.
I'm really glad I didn't see that one.
It's good though. Like if you have a chance to watch it, I would definitely recommend it.
Now that I'm an adult,
maybe we can watch it for St. Patrick's Day. There can be our actual plans.
Perfect.
We'll get together and watch Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
We'll watch that. We'll just get scared.
I will see if I can't find it on Amazon and buy it, because it's a good one.
Cool. Yeah, let's check it out.
You know, cute music and stuff in it.
And you guys at home, you guys should check it out too.
Yeah,
we should talk about it on our Facebook page.
Absolutely, check it out. You know, I will, when this comes out, I will like post a link to where you could buy it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it's available on any streaming services. Maybe the Disney streaming service it happens.
Maybe.
But yeah, it's a classic Disney movie that my parents introduced me to, and I like it.
Well, awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, we're coming up to a break. And after the break, we're going to chat. We're also talking about some families and not understanding and deaths and all that good stuff. I'm gonna step on your toes a little bit.
I'm curious. I have some suspicions of what families, because I mean,
maybe.
I don't want to say it yet. I'll wait until
did
after
the break.
Did
you peek at my notes?
No, I did not.
Oh, you jerk.
No, yeah, I swear. Liar. I swear I did not.
Okay.
I swear on the legend of the banshee, I did not.
I'm going to keep my notes secret for the next 5 seconds.
Okay.
You guys better still be here when we come back.
Okay, but when we come back, I'm going to give my guess of if it's this family, and you have to tell me if I'm right or not.
Okay.
Okay. All right, sounds we'll be great. Right back.
Right back.
All right, so we're back, and we're going to talk about some family.
Yeah, well, kind of. It's not a specific, well, a couple of specific families, but did you want to guess?
I want to guess at the families.
Nope.
So.
Yeah, go ahead. No, you can't.
The Kennedys.
Nope.
The Rothschilds.
Nope.
Okay, never mind then. Okay, that's all I had, because the Rothschilds are such an interesting conspiracy family.
We'll get there, I promise.
I mean, they're real people.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating conspiracy theory.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So this isn't them. So now I'm okay.
So like I said, I'm going to encroach on your territory a little bit here. I'm going to be talking about a conspiracy caused by a cryptid.
Oh.
Long before vaccine research and development fought back against the epidemic of tuberculosis, another method was much more popular: vampire hunting.
Yes.
That's right. Early New Englanders thought vampires were behind the disease.
Yes, they did.
Also known as the Great New England Vampire Panic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the disease back then was called consumption.
And I will get there.
I'm sorry.
What's the point of doing notes if you're going to read them for me? Jesus.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I love tuberculosis is one of my favorite, like, classic diseases to, like, talk about and research.
Mine too. It's really interesting in the way people treated it. And, mm-hmm. and this was a really interesting way to get around it that actually ends up kind of tying into something else. So, let's go break it down.
Let's break it down.
Because this wasn't just a blip in the timeline. It lasted almost an entire century.
Mm-hmm.
The connection allegedly originated in Eastern Europe, but somehow found its way to the 19th century New England. That's the 1800s,
yes,
Sammy.
Yes, thank you. I need that.
No one directly associated with the families or in the superstition would have necessarily used the term vampire to describe what was happening, but media outlets and educated outsiders compared the phenomena they were describing to the European myth of vampires. Mm-hmm. When people died of tuberculosis, it looked like they were being consumed by the disease, hence the synonym for it, consumption.
Mm-hmm.
In 1786, when health officials first began recording mortality rates connected to the deadly infection, Massachusetts alone recorded 300 consumption cases for every 100,000 residents.
Yeah.
Between that year and 1800, tuberculosis killed 2% of New England's population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a big number.
That's huge, especially for that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so contagious. Anywhere from 70 to 90% of the U.S. population had latent or active tuberculosis infections mm-hmm. around that time.
Yeah.
The symptoms of tuberculosis and the appearance of a decomposing body fueled the rumors of the connection. We now know it's a bacterial infection, mm-hmm. but no one at the time knew what caused it, and they wouldn't until the late century. And even after that, news spread so slowly, some people were still practicing the old methods despite further research.
Mm-hmm.
So they were still doing this weird method I'm going to come to. Common tuberculosis symptoms included red, swollen, light-sensitive eyes, mm-hmm. pale skin, low body temperature, and a weak heartbeat, and coughing up a foamy mixture of blood, as well as the breakdown of lung tissue during and after death from tuberculosis, which caused the lips of corpses to appear bloody.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mean, looking like a vampire.
Yep, exactly.
But along with the nickname came this conspiracy, because once one family member came down with and died from the highly contagious disease, other members of the house also soon got sick.
Mm-hmm.
Before modern medicine, we assumed the dead family member had become an entity or an intangible energy draining or consuming the remaining family member's life force from beyond the grave.
Yep.
They didn't believe that corpses actually left the grave to suck the blood of the living like Bram Stoker's Dracula. Mm-hmm. So they weren't like, you know, they become a vampire.
Right.
They're like,
they weren't,
you know,
undead or anything
like
that.
Suck your blood. They were like just sucking your life energy out from the grave.
Yep.
If multiple family members came down with a disease, the first step was to exhume patient zero and remove their heart.
Mm-hmm.
If the heart was filled with fresh blood, which was actually an effect of decomposition, mm-hmm. but believed to be the blood of the vampire had sucked out of the living, the heart would be burned and the ashes fed to sick family members as a cure, or a stake would be driven through the heart, something we still see associated with pop culture vampires mm-hmm. today.
Yep. The fact that they would, like, literally mix the ashes in with, like, water and stuff like that and be mm-hmm. like, here, just drink this.
Drink this.
I mean, it's like some of the, like, antiquated medicinal practices from, like, even only, like, you know, 100, 200 years ago is absolutely mind-blowing.
Absolutely.
You know,
the fact that it even was – we had to do that kind of weird stuff. It's like they first got to drink the milk of a cow.
Yeah.
It's like we have to do the weird stuff to figure out whether this stuff is good for us.
But I mean, it reminds me of this meme that I've seen where it was like, I wish I was an old-timey doctor where it's like, oh, you're sick? You have ghosts in your blood. Do some cocaine about it.
Exactly. or back in the days when they used to like prescribe, oh, you're addicted to cocaine? Here's some heroin. You'll get over it.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Let's give you something different to be addicted to.
Here's bear. Heart disease, bear. So there were 12 reported incidents of vampires in the 18th and 19th century New England.
Mm-hmm.
In 11 of those cases, the vampire and all its relatives died of consumption.
Yeah.
In 1784, a newspaper published a letter to the editor about a foreign quack doctor who had been spreading an unusual cure for consumption. According to the letter, when a third member of the family of Isaac Johnson was diagnosed with tuberculosis, the quack doctor advised he dug two family members.
I'm sorry. I hear quack doctor and I just immediately think of a duck in like a lab coat.
Quack.
Sorry. I watch too many cartoons,
okay.
You guys.
Okay, well, then here. According to the letter, when a third member of the family of Isaac Johnson was diagnosed with tuberculosis, the quack doctor advised he dig up two members who had already died of the illness. Bodies were inspected for any sprouting plants, and an eyewitness reported they actually found the herb sorrel growing inside the grave. The body's vital organs and the sorrel were removed and burned together, an idea the writer basically called absurd. Like, this quack doctor is just, come on. Like, they're like, can you believe this guy? Well, apparently a lot of people did. In Manchester, Vermont, 1793, Rachel Burton died age 20, 3 years before this incident, her exhumation, in 1790, which was when she died. Congregational Deacon Captain Isaac Burton exhumed his first wife, Rachel, in an attempt to save his second wife, Hulda, who was dying of tuberculosis. The effort failed, and Hulda died in September of that year. But if it was like 3 years later and he was already married again and saving a second wife from tuberculosis, I think there may have been some guilt there.
Probably.
Just a little.
Yeah. Now, wasn't it like common for like bodies from like affected with tuberculosis didn't compose it or didn't decompose at the same rate as others? So it's like a lot of times
there
when
was like the
exhume them, they still look kind of lifelike.
Not necessarily. Not, we will get there. There is a case that's kind of like that, but
right.
But not necessarily.
Okay. All right.
In New Ipswich, New Hampshire, circa 1810, Dr. John Clue of New Ipswich reported the influence of the mind on physical organization in the Boston Medical and Surgical Journal, Volume 21, in 1840. He said, quote, "In connection with these superstitions, I cannot omit to mention a circumstance which occurred in this town not 30 years since, and similar occurrences probably occurred in many other towns in New England. This was disinterring a human body which belonged to a family all strongly predisposed to consumption for the purpose of removing the heart, which was burned, the ashes of which were considered a sovereign remedy of those who of the family who were still living and might be affected with the same disease. This only illustrates the fact that these elements of character, which held such a magic sway over the minds of men in ancient times, have not ceased altogether to influence the community in our comparatively enlightened day." Basically, y'all are still barbarians.
Yes. Even back then, he realized they were barbarians.
Like, good God, guys. Then between 1816 to 1817 in Scioto County, Ohio, hey, Ohio, the family of Philip Saliday came from Switzerland, bought and settled a lot in the French Grant soon after the opening of the country for settlement. Hereditary consumption developed itself in the family sometime after their location to the area.
Right.
The head of the family and the oldest son had died of it, and others started to come down with the disease. So the head of the family, Philip, and his oldest son, they like used the same like methods before, but they chose only Philip's body to be exhumed and they used him as a sacrifice.
Gotcha.
And just kept burning his entrails periodically over the course of the winter between 1816 to 1817.
Gross.
But everybody else died in the family.
Gross.
In the 1860s, a doctor reported an anonymous family had tried to do the same ritual to themselves to save themselves from the vampires, but everyone died again anyway.
Right.
So
right.
Two brothers had allegedly contracted the disease and became drunkards trying to forget life before the end of their days. But the last the doctor had heard, they lived well into middle age and were in good health.
The alcohol killed the bacteria.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Basically her answer was just kind of like, I guess. Then we hear about Frederick Ransom.
Okay.
He lived in South Woodstock, Vermont, and he died of tuberculosis on Valentine's Day of 1817 at the age of 20. Lots of really young people caught down.
Younger people just tend to have not as like developed immune systems.
The sanitation. Yeah, it was poor in general.
It was gross back then.
Yeah.
We've romanticized,
exactly,
you know, that time period so much, but it was so gross and unsanitary back then.
Exactly. So, but his father was worried that Ransom would come back and attack his family, so he had him exhumed and his heart burned on a blacksmith's forge. Dramatic.
Ooh. Yeah, a little bit.
Woo. Ransom was a Dartmouth College student from a well-to-do family, so it was highly unusual that he fell victim to the vampire panic in the first place, which was most common among less educated communities.
Right, right. Yeah, and that makes sense, you know, because usually the more educated, the more you know that it's a disease, not just...
Understand that there's some science to it.
Yeah, yeah, it's not just superstition.
However, Frederick also proves the disease wasn't restricted to the affluent community. Other notable people who contracted the disease were actually George Washington, James mm-hmm. Monroe, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, Washington Irving, and Doc Holliday.
Yeah.
Now we're going to talk about the one that you just mentioned, about the one that didn't quite decay.
Right. This one's super interesting.
One of the most famous cases from this is that of 19-year-old Mercy Lena Brown mm-hmm. in 1892 in Rhode Island. Mercy's mother, Mary Eliza, contracted consumption, which spread to the rest of the family, moving to her sister, Mary Olive. After they died, her brother, Edwin, and Mercy herself contracted the disease. Edwin was sent out to Colorado Springs, a dry climate, to recover, but he didn't improve, so he came back. But right. in that time, Mercy had already contracted it and died herself.
Right.
Neighbors believe that one of the family members was a vampire who had the illness. And 2 months after Mercy's death, her father, George, who did not believe a vampire was to blame, reluctantly permitted others to exhume the bodies of his family on March 17th, 1982.
Mm-hmm. Wait, 1982?
I'm sorry, 1892.
I was like, what?
He's like, he lived a really long... Now, who's the vampire?
I was like, wait a second. People were still doing this in the 1980s? I mean, they did weird things in the 1980s, but not that weird.
I mean, you never know. I mean, who knows what
Deb and Karen.
Karen are up to now. Susan. She was a trip. So both Mary and Olive's bodies showed the expected level of decomposition, but they found Mercy's body showed very little decay, mm-hmm. had fresh blood in her heart, and I found mixed reports on whether she had turned over in the grave.
Right.
Some people said she had flipped over, said she hadn't. This was enough to convince the villagers that Mercy Brown was the cause of the consumption in the first place.
Yeah.
The heart and liver of the exhumed body were burned, mixed with water, and then given to her surviving brother to stop the influence of the undead. Mm-hmm. Unsurprisingly, the cure was unsuccessful, and he died 2 months later.
Right.
As for her lack of decomposition, that was likely due to the fact that she was stored for only 9 weeks in freezer-like conditions in an above-ground crypt during the months following her death.
Right.
So she's basically refrigerated.
Gotcha.
In fact, the first episode of Lore, that podcast that mm-hmm. got turned into an Amazon show, is focused on Miss Mercy Brown, and so for more information, you guys can check her out.
That's where I'd learned about that. Yeah, you guys should definitely check out the Lore podcast. Yeah. It's super interesting.
It really is, and I love their show.
And they kind of go into a lot of the history behind mm-hmm. things like this. And,
yeah.
And, oh, it's just
I like
so
how it's structured.
Fascinating.
It's cool. So then anthropologist George R. Stetson connected the New England beliefs to similar rituals from Russia, Hungary, Prussia, and Serbia, as well as other parts of Europe, ancient Greece, and the Caribbean. In his 1896 article, The Animalistic Vampire in New England, Stetson described the case of one unnamed mason who credited his own health to the ritual. The man had two brothers who contracted the disease. One brother died, and someone suggested they completed the ritual I've mentioned. Mm-hmm. The second brother said no, and so when that brother died, the mason got sick. He said, sure, go for it, save my life. They mm-hmm. exhumed the body and found the blood in the living blood in the heart,
right.
and they held a cremation, and the unnamed mason soon recovered.
Ooh.
So that was like the one instance where it might have worked.
One time where it worked.
Exactly.
And that's the one time that people believed.
Yeah.
Probably.
10 years after Mercy Brown's exhumation in 1892, Robert Koch discovered the bacteria that caused tuberculosis. Mm. Poor nutrition and unsanitary and crowded living conditions in New England at the time would have created the perfect breeding ground for the disease.
Of course.
Henry David Thoreau even wrote in his journal in 1859, "The savage in man is never quite eradicated. I have just read of a family in Vermont who, several of its members having died of consumption, just burned the lungs and heart and liver of the last deceased in order to prevent any more from having it," as a reference to contemporary superstition.
Right.
So that was before he even had it, but I'm sure he was even looking at it going, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
So today we understand germ theory and that the disease is spread by bacteria being coughed up into the air.
Mm-hmm.
So now the burning of the heart and the feeding of ashes to surviving family members actually wasn't as crazy as an idea as we might think.
Oh, really?
They just had the wrong type of illness. This is actually similar to how smallpox, which is a virus, not a bacterial infection, right, was eradicated. The first clear reference to smallpox inoculation was made by a Chinese author, Wan Quan, in a journal published in 1549. It quotes the earliest hints of this practice in the 10th century. In China, they would grind up the smallpox scabs to a powder and blow them up the nose of the healthy.
Ooh.
People would then develop a mild case of the disease, and from then on, they were immune to it.
Right.
It did have about a 0.5% to 2% mortality rate, right, but those were better odds than the 20% to 30% mortality rate without it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Rhode Islanders who believe the vampire epidemic were often referred to as uneducated and, like, vicious.
Right.
But
I mean, it had some grounds in...
Technically, we eventually ended up creating vaccines based on that.
I mean, so basically, that was the... original smallpox vaccine was a ground up scab blown up the nose.
Exactly.
Gross, but effective.
Exactly. So obviously we've come a very, very long way since believing that tuberculosis was caused by vampires, and modern science has created vaccines and treatments to prevent death and the spreading of dangerous illnesses like this one. First successful vaccine to be developed and used in mass production was for smallpox and was introduced in 1796 by Edward Jenner. Mm-hmm. He observed that milkmaids who had previously caught cowpox did not later catch smallpox by showing that inoculated cowpox protected against inoculated smallpox.
Hmm.
That research later led to the creation of the BCG vaccine by Albert Calmette and a French physician and bacteriologist, and his assistant and later colleague, Camille Guérin, which was used on humans by 1921.
Mm-hmm.
The people responsible for spreading a theory like this didn't necessarily believe in vampires or witchcraft.
Right.
They were just desperate for a cure to a disease that was spreading like wildfire.
Yeah, they needed something
to blame,
you know.
And even in 1742, Voltaire reported that the Chinese had practiced that smallpox inoculation,
right,
for at least 100 years, and that was in 1742.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, the Wan Quan man had published it in 1549.
Right.
So we really started to figure this out actually a lot sooner than now. The vaccines have been around for a very long
time.
And if you want a really good thriller about the New England vampires, Salem's Lot by Stephen King, it's an excellent read, and it'll really freak you out. But that one actually has a really good backstory as to how Salem's Lot was written.
Hmm.
I highly suggest you guys go look it out. Look it up and
ooh.
Highly suggest you guys go look it up and check that out.
Cool.
So yeah.
Well, that was super fascinating.
Was that interesting?
Like I said, I love all the stories about consumption and tuberculosis because it was such a rampant disease, mainly in our country. Like, yes, it affected other countries too, but like our country had like a very long history of tuberculosis, just completely ripping apart the country.
It's so common, so contagious, and it killed so many people that we can even see it in pop culture. When somebody on television coughs up blood, we go, consumption.
Yeah.
They got tuberculosis. Yep. Moulin Rouge. Like, yep. I mean, not to spoil any movies for people, but
it's instant knowledge now. You know,
yeah.
It's super common knowledge, especially in this country, you know, that... you know, what the symptoms of tuberculosis
very
are.
Identifiable.
And yeah, it's crazy. Like I said, people were looking for something to blame, you know, because back then the concept of bacteria was barely known, if known at all. You know, it was still such a very, very new concept.
Even though it was paranoia, they were so close.
They were close.
Even with that, they were so close that burning the heart of somebody who had it, that had contracted the disease, they were so close. It was just the wrong type of disease to do something like that and to actually have an effect. So they were right there.
Yeah.
And that out of fear, we figured it out, but just didn't take that extra step forward.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
No, and it's just, you know.
Until later.
Yeah. No. But I mean, it's always, like I said, now we definitely have romanticized that time period, you know, but it's still... it was such an age of discovery because things like, you know, bacteria, germs, viruses were being discovered. Vaccines were being discovered. Penicillin was being discovered. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating, you know, that some people were intelligent enough to think this is, you know, this isn't vampires. This is some thing we can't see causing a disease.
That's so tiny
that we can't see it, but it's still there, and here's how we can fight it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's it's incredible.
Just that we stop losing loved ones, you know, and stop and to protect ourselves, you know, self-preservation of a species. So I think that, you know, humans are just so incredible and that we shouldn't, you know, let hundreds of years of research, thousands of years of research to just, you know, fall to the wayside. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. So, you know,
that's a good segue into vaccinate your kids.
Yeah.
I'm unapologetic about that. Yeah. If we lose listeners because they don't want to vaccinate their kids, that's not a listener base I want.
Yeah.
Please vaccinate your children.
Please vaccinate your babies. Because there's a lot of research. And
we don't need a resurgence of tuberculosis in this country.
Or measles. We've already had 800 people, I think, die in Madagascar of measles.
We've had a bunch die in this country.
Yeah. I mean, just in this year, over the past 12 months, I don't know the exact number. I have no problem
getting on a soapbox about that.
Nope.
You know, if you would rather have your child die from measles or tuberculosis than get autism, then there's a problem there. But there's also the problem of vaccines don't cause autism.
Yeah. Yeah. And that even the guy that came out and said that
the guy that wrote that,
he said it was
said he made it up
crap
for views. He literally wrote clickbait and admitted to it. So
you know, but I encourage people that even if you aren't sure, to do your research and to talk to other people and to talk to other people who are educated and have conversations, and, you know, don't treat it as I can't talk to my friends that are, you know, politically motivated on one side of the aisle or the other, but to have these conversations with each other, because we learn from speaking to each other. So sorry to get on our soapboxes here.
Yeah. I just don't want to see our country take another trip to Consumption Junction.
Yeah, exactly. Choo-choo.
Consumption Junction. And what's your function? All right, guys. we choked up Ian.
Sorry.
Sorry, producer Ian. All right, guys. Well, this has been kind of a short episode this week.
We're really sorry.
But I mean, most of you are probably going to be super liquored up in a day or two anyway and probably won't even remember. So
happy St. Patrick's Day, and, you know, have a good, you know, avoid the banshees. Don't get consumption.
Avoid your banshees. Probably avoid the leprechauns too, because their gold is fake.
Yeah, go win the lottery, guys.
Go win the lottery instead. That has a better chance of sticking around.
Have a lucky day.
You know, eat your potatoes and corned beef hash. Drink your green beer.
Yes.
You know, have some Irish pride. Even if you're not Irish, welcome to the Irish family.
Kiss your Irish friends, but ask first, guys.
Yeah,
please.
Not consumption. what's the word? I just lost it.
Mono is contagious.
No, I mean, yeah, mono is contagious, but consent is cool. Consumption is not cool. Consent is cool. So, you know, kiss them if they're Irish after you've asked for permission.
Exactly. So we'll say consent is cool. Consumption is not. There we go. Protect yourselves. Wear a condom.
God.
Okay, we're done here.
We've gone so far off the trail. Okay.
Drag Sammy out the door. Good night, guys. All right.
Talk to you guys later. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.
Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Conspiracies and Cryptids with Sammy and Tessa. Don't forget to check out our website, www.conspiraciesandcryptids.com, for more episodes and other information.
And if you're really enjoying what we're doing, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/cryptipod. That's CRYPTIPOD. There you can find different ways to support us and get some awesome goodies along the way.
While you're at it, you can also find us on all of your favorite social media platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's any one of those at Cryptipod.
And if you're enjoying our podcast, please think about leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. Leave us 5 stars and a nice little blurb about why you like us. It helps us to gain some traction and find some new listeners.
And while you're at it, don't forget to tell your friends, because our friends are your friends.
And don't forget, Big Brother is watching.